The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher, go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power, and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one, because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined today by Angus Hanton, who is an entrepreneur, investor and researcher. He also co-founded the Intergenerational Foundation, and he has written a book called Vassal State: How America Runs Britain. I'm also joined to discuss this very interesting topic by William Clouston, who is head of the Social Democratic Party. And we're just going to be talking about whether America really does run Britain, as you state in your book. And I thought I'd start, I was going to do it in an American accent, but I'm not feeling up to it, by quoting this quote from Denny Ludwell, who wrote America Conquers Britain. He says, "We were Britain's colony once. She will be our colony before she's done. Not in name, but in fact. But we shan't make Britain's mistake. Too wise to govern the world, we shall merely own it. Nothing can stop us. Nothing. What chance has Britain got against America?" And that's a pretty good question, isn't it, in the modern world? What chance does Britain have against America? I mean, what I found very striking about your book is the extent to which everything in Britain is already owned by America.
It is extraordinary how much of the high street, how much of our industry, and obviously tech, is US-owned, US-controlled. But there's a lot we can do. It's far more ownership by Americans in the UK than there is in Germany or France. So it has been a policy choice, and it's an ongoing policy choice. Even in the last few weeks, we've seen companies being taken over by American corporations without any challenge. They bought, for example, to take one iconic example, they've just bought the Post Office Tower, or BT Tower.
I understand everything you're saying, particularly about private equity and so on, buying up a lot of Britain. But isn't that partly because of the language? Isn't that partly because there isn't a natural alliance between Britain and America that has actually been beneficial in some ways to Britain, where it hasn't for Europe?
Certainly the language helps, and also the legal systems and so on. But I think it's really a choice. The relationships become completely unbalanced. It's been special in some ways, but it's been very special for the Americans, especially profitable.
And you think it's become far more so in the era of big tech?
I think since about 2009, the big tech companies in the UK have absolutely ballooned in size and in the scope of their control. Yes, so it has become much bigger. And that's the same period when we've had low interest rates and private equity has expanded. So we've had these three prongs: private equity, big tech, and the conventional big US multinationals, Exxon and Procter & Gamble and so on. They've all grown their footprint in the UK.
And one thing that struck me that I hadn't really ever thought about before is just transactions, that America controls all our transactions.
America's fought a war. American corporations have fought a war against cash, and they've won. Compared to other European countries, we use credit cards so much more. You'll go into shops and cafes where cash is just not accepted, and that's been hugely to the benefit of the big American money transaction companies: Visa, MasterCard, Apple Pay, Google Pay. And their idea is that they want to be involved, make a profit from every transaction. And actually they do now.
William, I'll bring you in, because the SDP is probably the only party in Britain that really campaigns on this issue and, you know, talks about the fact that Britain has sold off all its major enterprises. We've sold our economy. But I wonder, you know, the danger is you just end up sounding nostalgic about an era of Britain that you know, is no longer there. And really, you're shaking your fist at the sun, and the sun is that America is the global superpower. There's nothing we can really do about it.
Certainly we're the only party that talks about this stuff. We produced a green paper a few years ago called The End of Indifference. And what we try to do is to take seriously the roots of the problem. And the roots of the problem are basically cultural, I think. We're governed by a political class that don't care where stuff is made, and in particular don't care who owns anything. You know, they don't care. I mean, largely our successive governments as Angus points out in the book, have acted as seen the country as a shop and will literally fence off our assets to whoever will buy them. And many of the buyers are American corporations, but they're not the only ones. And the long-term consequences of basically selling the silver is beggary. And that's where we are. I mean, we've transformed an economy based on production in the 50s, 60s, 70s to one based on debt. And we are headed for basic feudalism as very large corporations bleed us out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're in dire straits. And so one of the projects, I mean, one of the great things about Angus's book is that it will raise awareness about this. I spend a lot of time in SW1 and I'm astonished by the ignorance of the political class on these things. I mean, basic economics of international trade. You speak to most politicians, they don't even think about, not aware of it. And a lot of the FDI that Angus is referring to is just the flip side of running a very, very large trade deficit for 30 years.
Angus, that is something you talk about. You say the starting point needs to be measurement. We need to know exactly the numbers. Can you give us some of the more, there's lots of staggering numbers in your book, but just give us some of the highlights in terms of American ownership.
Well, it happens that this week the Americans have published the numbers for how much their multinationals sell to the UK, and it's $800 billion a year. Now, that for most people, that just seems like a big number. But if you put $800 billion into sterling and then into a per household measure, it's equivalent to £23,000 per UK house every year. Now, that includes government spending, so that's a huge part of the economy. And one of my favourite games, in a way, during the writing of this book has been to use Google, one of our large American friends, to use Google to search. Whenever I come across a company where I don't know who owns them, I say, who owns CRH, for example, or who owns Boots? And I look up the answer, and so often, more than half the time, it turns out to be an American company, very often private equity. So it goes right through the economy, and it's not just in the high street, not just in supermarkets, but it's very much sort of behind the scenes, a lot of what we call business-to-business companies.
Well, one obvious criticism, and it's one that some of your reviewers have made, is that, you know, what would you rather? Because the alternative at the moment would be Chinese ownership, and you talk about the example of Huawei in the book.
Well, I think this is a council of despair to say, would you rather be owned by Americans, Russians or Chinese? I'd rather be owned by ourselves. Yeah. I think the idea of selling off the country or feeling we've just got to choose one suitor, there's a more legitimate question, who would you rather trade with? But here we're talking about the sale of the family silver. I'd rather that we kept it. I'd rather we developed it and that we built up our businesses.
William, that's a good point, Angus makes. Why do you think Britain is quite fatalistic about globalization and the end? Because as Angus points out in his book, you know, the French have more industrial protections. They have the Danone law, which was kind of brought in to protect a major French business. What is it about Britain that is so willing to sell out?
The reason for that, Freddie, is that our political class has drunk the free trade purist Kool-Aid. The problem with free trade libertarianism is that it's easy to understand. A lot of our political class read a bit of Hayek or Friedman at university, and they prioritize their ideology over the national interest. So the French get it, the South Koreans and the Japanese get it. The South Koreans and Japanese would never allow the corporate takeovers that we have allowed. And we've allowed them because we're governed by people that are ideological. In fact, on the sort of progressive left, they don't really like the nation state very much, and they're a little bit embarrassed about the idea of protectionism and putting the national self-interest, national citizen preference, they don't like that idea. And on the libertarian right, they just don't care. And they think that it doesn't matter. This is, again, one of the things that the book is very good at drawing out, is that it really does matter. I mean, who owns what matters? Because you end up paying profits and rents out, and you will just, at the end of each year of this, we own less and we owe more. And if you continue doing that, you're headed for serious beggary. And you can stop it. I mean, I'm not despairing of this. There's about five or six things a self-assertive government could do to pull it back. And we will not be respected by anyone if we don't.
And you talk about the free market idealism there. And I think what a lot of people don't realise, and I wonder whether you agree with this, both of you, is that America isn't open about its own interests. It isn't as willing to sell as we are. It has Buy American policies. Anybody who's tried to set up a business in America who's not American will know about the obstacles that are in your way and the way that the IRS or whatever will make life very difficult for you if you're successful.
I think that's absolutely right. The Americans believe in free trade, and we believe in free trade, but that's free trade in goods and services, not free trade in our companies. Yeah. The Americans protect their companies, and not only do they protect them, but they support them through the government. I mean, the US Embassy in London has increased in the number of people there by 50% over the last 5 or 6 years. Mm. And those people are not just talking about politics and diplomacy. Many of them are really promoting American business interests in the UK and in Europe. So we have a very, very backward attitude in Westminster to supporting companies. One of the things that I noticed is how important the hometown advantage is. Right across America, there are cities and towns that have one dominant employer, and they have a great relationship between the town and the company, and the company builds local amenities, theatres, tennis courts, and supports apprentices. Whereas in the UK, we've lost that. Every time a company's taken over, wherever it's based, it becomes hollowed out.
And William, do we need an industrial policy? Is that what you'd call it?
Yes, you've got to know what you're trying to do. And an industrial policy, for instance, that looked at trade to address our massive trade problem would be helpful. You know, we might have an energy policy that supports industry as well. We might decide to seriously promote import substitution and so on. But we won't do it without it. And, you know, again, there's been a hostility because of the ideology and the political class to doing any of this. They just don't believe in it. I mean, there's a hostility to planning of any kind. Planning is a dirty word. It's very foolish because, you know, the interests of US multinationals is not the national interest. And, you know, we better learn quickly to promote our own interests. And I think we can do it, like a lot of other problems, like the migration crisis or whatever. I think we can do it if we want to do it. That's the first thing.
Also, I suppose there's a question of the whole way that Americans promote their own businesses. They have a sort of Buy American policy, and we just don't have that. And it's not just about promoting what private companies do, it's about government buying. So the NHS is a huge buyer of American, not just drugs and fittings and prostheses and so on, but it's a huge buyer of tech services. All the database for the NHS is based on an Oracle system, an American system, supported by Microsoft and stored on Amazon's cloud. So we should think about how government buys. And of course, the MOD is completely dependent on American buying, and not just for things that we can't supply, not just for fighter jets and nuclear weapons, which are made in America, but we're dependent on the US for in the MOD for the back end services, for looking after the military bases. So we could have a Buy British policy, and it would be totally rational and in our interests.
You mentioned the MOD. I was thinking that about Rishi Sunak raising defence spending over the next 15 years. A lot of that money is going to end up back in America.
Absolutely. When the Americans say that we should be spending more on defence, they're effectively also saying we should be spending more on their companies.
Yeah. William, I do want to go on about this point about, you know, why Britain in particular seems so vulnerable to this. And obviously there's the language, there's the free market ideology, but there is also a lack of patriotic thinking, I think, that in America, big companies are always thinking about business. The business of America is business. But they think about it in a more nationalistic way, do they not?
I think they do. I think certainly government does. I wouldn't overestimate that. I mean, there's some very good critiques of American businesses shutting down, you know, the company town and moving production overseas. And Chris Lash wrote on that years ago, you know, and these executives being, you know, foreigners in their own country. So it's not to say that they get it perfectly right, but we just don't do it at all. I mean, you know, major takeovers, Cadbury's and so on, just get waved through, and it just wouldn't happen in another country. So I totally agree, Freddie. I think there is a lack of patriotism, and maybe this is why I think, you know, the SDP, we always talk about cultural problems. I mean, we focus on economics and housing, trade a lot. But I think the root cause of this is cultural. You know, it's how we're educated, it's what we're prepared to do. And you almost get David Goodhart, in his excellent book, wrote to somewhere a few years ago, talked about the head of the civil service talking about British government acting in the global interest, not the national interest. And I always thought when I read that, I thought, what the hell are you doing? Why? How are you head of the civil service if that's what you think?
Yeah.
And we've become very much working for the Americans, not just as a nation, but individually. So quite often in Westminster, people say there are there's 1 million Brits working for American corporations. But I did the numbers, and it's changed since they got their numbers. And it's now 2 million Brits working for American corporations. And that contradicts what's said by the American ambassador and by former chancellors. And that contrasts with other European countries. I mean, the French and the Germans have about 400,000 people each working for American corporations. The Spanish and Italians have 200,000. So that's a fraction of what we've got. So we're in a very literal sense working for the Americans.
You've been accused of being anti-American. I'm an unashamed Americanophile. How do you respond to that? Do you feel anti-American?
I'm absolutely not anti-American. It's more pro-British.
Yeah.
No, I like my iPhone as much as the next person, and I use Google as I've said, and I respect what they've done and the effectiveness. I drive a Tesla. I'm not in awe of them, but I respect good products. That doesn't contradict saying, well, when we've got great defence companies, for example, like Ultra and Meggitt, we don't want them to be sold to Americans. Those are great companies.
And you're not an anti-capitalist?
It's absolutely not anti-capitalist. This is about making capitalism work for us. I mean, of course, capitalism has its flaws, and there's a big debate about that. This isn't about that. Mm. This is saying, how can we, in our capitalism, be more like the Germans and the French and have a model that is independent of America and not in hock to them? And as William says, the danger of this is that we make ourselves impoverished. Because the American corporations pay so little tax, that we drive up the tax that we have to pay, that it destroys our communities. And the other thing is, we lose people. We lose good people in tech and science and universities. Because the Americans can pay more and they want talent, they take many of our people.
And you mentioned Brexit in the book. Do you regard Brexit as a shame because it has made us more vulnerable to this American takeover?
Well, as we move away from Europe, we inevitably move closer to America. Mm. And America is a very transactional country, and it sees that as an opportunity to make the best of the situation. And one of the ways they've done that is refused to do a trade deal with us, and they hold that question of the trade deal over our heads. So we may have floated off from Europe, but we haven't floated into their open arms. Mm. We floated into a position where we are, as I put it in the title, their vassal. We're there to serve them, and our economy is working largely for them.
William, what would the SDB response be to that? I mean, do you think Brexit has made our condition of vassalage to America greater?
It has, because of the lack of appetite for self-governance among our ruling class. Yes, it has, but it didn't need to. We argued for Brexit on the Lexit side to do a bit of planning and industrial policy and keep a steelworks or two open. And what we have to confess, what we underestimated in the vote, was that our political class really weren't up for it. And we need to remind ourselves that the Tory party never had a policy of leaving the European Union, didn't want to do it. And then when they were given their freedom, didn't know what to do with it, and were just unaccustomed to self-governance. So they've missed the opportunity to date to take advantage of it. Just to, you know, I mean, just to go back to your point about being anti-American, we are not at all. I mean, my daughter-in-law is American. On the weekend, I managed to be at the Yankees game and at the New York Rangers game. And I love America, but I want this country to govern itself in its own interests.
But William, if you were watching football, there's a good chance you'd be watching an American-owned team. I worked out that 52% of the turnover in the Premier League it goes to Americans. Of the 20 clubs, 9 of them are US-owned, so those tend to be the bigger clubs. Mm. So it is a domination that we had a choice about.
To go back to the would you rather be owned by China point, I take your point that no, you'd rather be owned by Britain, run by Britain and so on, but it's possibly a bit unrealistic in the modern world. I mean, you are going to have foreign ownership of things. Things are going to be bought and they are going to go to the highest buyer, and the highest buyer is often going to be a foreigner.
Not at all. I think what we've done is we've set up a system with our investments and our tax, particularly our tax, that it pays to sell out. if you sell out, if you're a medium or small sized business and you're an owner of that business and you sell out, you pay 20% capital gains tax at most, and there are some exemptions, so you may well pay less. Whereas if you carry on trading, you'll end up paying 45 or 50% tax on your profits once you've taken them out of the company. So certainly a minimum you'll pay the corporation tax rate of 25%, so you'll pay more that way. Whereas the American and other people who take over companies, because they're so tax advantaged, because there are legal ways for them to reduce the tax burden, it makes the purchase price much more attractive. So no, I don't think it's inevitable that we sell out, and particularly that we sell out at scale.
William, something Angus talks about in the book is the way that America, and again, we're not being Americophobic here, I hope, but America is very aggressive whenever its interests, business interests, are threatened. For instance, Angus talks about the digital sales tax that Donald Trump was very, very firmly against. And with Huawei, you know, and often things that are seen to be a Chinese threat, it's actually more about protecting American business, is it not?
It is, yeah. I mean, the sales tax, digital sales tax, is the classic example, but it's an appalling outcome to have a situation where, you know, powerful US multinational trade in this country, pay very little tax, set up tax arrangements to avoid tax, and end up paying more tax in America on the turnover in the UK than our treasury get. And that is, it cannot be allowed to continue. I mean, we've got to be more assertive. I think if you take a really broad view on this, you have to go back a long time to find a prime minister that stood up to the Americans on a matter of major importance. And I think Wilson is the last time this actually happened over Vietnam. You have to go back a long time.
That's absolutely right, William, about the UK politicians being in hock, in awe of the American system. Slightly to my surprise, I found that all of the recent prime ministers and chancellors either worked for American corporations before they came to office or after they left office, almost all of them, including people like Gordon Brown, Theresa May, certainly Kwasi Kwarteng, and of course the most extreme example is probably Rishi Sunak, who owns a flat in California, has worked for Goldman Sachs and other American companies, and they are, by culturally, they are very much looking to America and in awe of America and very worried about offending them in any way. So they've totally, as you put it, drunk the Kool-Aid.
I think that's a very interesting point. And you, Nick Clegg and Philip Hammond, you mentioned too. Also,
absolutely. Nick Clegg as Deputy Prime Minister has then gone to work for many years as Facebook's ambassador around the world. He no doubt uses his contacts in Westminster and Europe to advance the interests of Facebook and now Meta, a huge American corporation. Yes.
Isn't that partly, though, I mean, I often think with this, with sort of politicians selling out and so on, is that they want to be rich, which is a very natural, understandable impulse. But actually just being rich today means selling out at a much bigger scale than it used to. If you want to have a comfortable life, a very comfortable life, as a lot of these politicians do, then they have to sell out in this way.
Perhaps we should encourage less of a culture of an individual selling out and more of a culture of a family building up family wealth, a bit more like the Mittelstand in Germany, where a company is built up for his or her children. It's not being done for a quick sellout. Mm. And then they become part of the community. And the idea of some of those entrepreneurs selling out to American or other buyers is just unthinkable.
Yes. William, that's an interesting concept, a sort of familial role in the nation's economy. I mean, the Americans certainly do that.
You've got to use straplights in politics. And I moan about being governed by people that see the country, our country, either as a shop or as a charity. And I, you know, the SDP's position is not a shop or a charity, it's our home. And if you take a rooted attitude to where you live, a place-based attitude, it is, then you end up with faith, flag and family, which is much more rooted than the sort of individualism we've had. And we do need a switch to that. And it will cost us if we don't wake up. A lot of Angus's book is basically about getting us to wake up and look at how things are. Mm-hmm. And be able to respond to them.
There's a chapter on private equity in the book, and that is really at the heart of what we're talking about here, because the private equity dominates the modern economy. But it does play, it may be very destructive, but it is an efficiency in a way, is it not? And that is why it plays such an important role.
What I've described private equity investors or barons as is excellent extractors of capital. They're very good at borrowing cheaply. They're very good at recognising where the profits are. They're very good at cutting costs. Now, I don't think this is a very good model for capitalism. It doesn't recognise the huge range of stakeholders that traditional quoted companies used to do, from employees and communities. So I think it's very extractive. And I think we've done very little to control it. And one of the things that private equity is excellent at is avoiding tax. Mm. And we're, as a society, we've turned a blind eye to that.
Do you not think, though, eventually the market might find ways of resolving this? I mean, Merrin Somerset Webb has written this book about shareholder capitalism, return of shareholder capitalism, and that, you know, because of the technology now, you have the ability to buy shares more quickly. You have a return of retail shareholder capitalism. Could that not be an answer there?
The problem is that the big American companies are so good at waiting till someone emerges as a successful entrepreneur and buying up their business. Yeah. So it's very difficult unless you're really determined to stay independent. And for young entrepreneurs who are doing well, they've got families, and as you say, they want to cash in.
So I'm going to indulge this fantasy because I like it. Let's say I start a AI startup and it's doing extremely well, and some American tech giant offers me several billion to sell it. In your ideal scenario, the government would stop that transaction, even because I'm going to take it because I'm greedy.
Well, absolutely, you'll take it. But there are lots of things that the British government can do to make it less likely that you'll take it. One of which is to make your tax position such that it's not an advantage to you. Mm. Another of which is to make the buyer aware that they're going to be paying full tax on any profits they make in the future. So that would be a change. That would make it less likely to happen. Mm. For you, it might well be a more attractive option, and it should be made more attractive, to sell a part of your stake. Mm. So that you still are cashed in, but you're still running the sort of baby that you've created.
William, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to the broader point, I agree with Angus. I think a lot of the private equity model is an asset stripping model. The tax code that we have prioritizes debt over equity. And a lot of, not just American, but other private equity operators target companies that have built up assets, physical assets, often property, and they'll take a company over, load it with debt that's tax advantaged, do sale and leasebacks, effectively sell the assets, and then just milk it. And it's not helpful. I mean, in one of the industries that I'm very aware of, this was absolutely disastrous and almost bankrupt the company. So no, it's not long-term thinking. It's very short-term. And again, if you want to address it, you can if you want to. You have to change the incentives, particularly through the tax code.
Is the problem here a kind of loss of morality in capitalism? I mean, I think Adam Smith, he talked about the invisible hand, but he also said that the invisible hand had to be guided by Christianity, effectively, that you had to have a sense of right and wrong throughout capitalism, and that, you know, private equity overloading on debt, leveraging out companies is clearly sort of morally dubious at best. And we've lost that.
We absolutely have. But one of the things we've lost as well is that the way the economy works has changed so much. And it's moved towards the way that America wants it to work. It's not just that we've sold our businesses, which we've been concentrating here on. It's that what we've lost is the bridges and the pipes, the ways through which we do business. And so that so many platforms that we use are American, virtually all platforms that we use are American owned. Mm. So that if we want to go on a holiday, we may book something through Airbnb. So someone in California is taking a cut from that. When we pay for it, as we've discussed, you're paying usually with an American credit card, so there's a cut there. If you want to do dating through Bumble or Tinder, it's going to an American company. Those platforms are American owned, so the question of morality to some extent doesn't arise. Mm. We naturally want to go through the easiest route, and they've been hugely successful. If we sell something secondhand, we'll sell it through eBay. Mm. So technology has really helped American corporations, and we need at least initially to recognise the problem.
I think I do recognise the problem, but I do sometimes wonder about, you know, maybe we are a vassal state to America, but perhaps being a vassal state to America is not so bad, given that they are, like all major superpowers in history, an empire. They have empirical tendencies, but their empirical tendencies are quite benign, relatively.
Well, we need not to confuse the military political with the commercial. Yes, we're under their umbrella militarily, but so are the Germans, so are the French, so are all NATO members. And we can do that without selling out. It's the extent to which we've sold out our economy and allowed that to be dominated by America that I'm questioning. So you can still have your pro-Americanism without being owned by them. And being a vassal state does, we must emphasise, does lead to constant increase in poverty. One illustration of that is the loss of treasure or artworks. I mean, every year about £3 billion worth of artworks go across the Atlantic to wealthy American museums. And so we become impoverished in that dimension as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think to pick up your point about morality and capitalism, I mean, this isn't new in a sense. Chesterton and Belloc wrote about this over 100 years ago, and there's the famous Chesterton quote that the working man has a stake in his locality because the rich man can go off on a yacht in the South Seas. And it's true, the South Seas this time is California. People just go and take the opportunity to get on a plane and leave. So that is an issue. I think Angus's book is about economics mainly, but this is a broader problem of overreach and penetration into our society by America in other domains as well. They're separate subjects, but you know the cultural aspect is massive. You know, you have something like BLM, an event in the States, and you get a tidal wave, a cultural tidal wave throughout the Anglosphere that rips through, and we seem powerless to resist this. I'd also point out that the foreign military interventionism that we have been dragged into in Iraq and Afghanistan was utterly disastrous, half-baked, stupid. And we did it because the Americans encouraged us to. And we need to find our own way of asserting our national interests.
That's a very interesting point about the military element. As you say, you want to distinguish between these things. But, I mean, Britain, it has, we've been called America's lapdog and so on, and strategy. Britain has followed America, and for understandable reasons, because, I mean, there is a West. It is based on freedom and things that we find important. And America is our natural ally there. And we don't have to get sentimental about the special relationship to believe that.
Well, it's one thing to be an ally. It's another to be a lapdog. And I think the danger is that whatever our Foreign Office is focusing on what the Americans do and just doing more, a little bit less of the same. And we're copying them, even in effectively foreign adventures. It's not about not being an ally. It's about having a degree of independence.
Well, one politician you talk about in the book is Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, you think of her and Reagan as the sort of golden years of the special relationship. And you talk about how the selling off of British companies started under her.
It absolutely started under her, but she would, I think, be horrified at the extent to which it's gone. Mm. I mean, when she was in power, about 3% of the stock exchange, FTSE companies, 3% of shares were owned by Americans. It's now over 30%. Mm. So I don't think she was thinking we open up our markets, but we don't sell them off. Yeah. So she, yes, of course she was pro-American, and of course she was pro-privatisation, but I think not to the extent that we've been. And one of the things is, people often talk about, for example, private equity as if it's a kind of across the board phenomenon. But what once you study it, you see that almost all private equity takeovers in the UK are by American private equity. Mm. And we talk about big tech. But when you think about it, it's not really big tech, it's big US tech. And I think that's something that Margaret Thatcher would have been very aware of.
William, do you agree with that? Do you think, I mean, Thatcher's legacy is debated very hotly, but do you agree that if she were alive today, she would be horrified at the extent of the corporate takeover, international corporate takeover?
Very possibly. It was Peregrine Worsthorn, wasn't he, that said that Thatcher managed to make a country that was more like the values of a son than a father. She possibly would be disappointed, but it started. I mean, I think, the big lie about Thatcherite economics is that it was successful. I mean, the GDP growth in the 60s and 70s was higher than after Thatcherism was implemented. It was disastrous. I've argued many a time that the cost of mopping up the blood, particularly on deindustrialization, the Midlands and the North, vastly outweighs any benefits you think you've got from privatizations and deindustrialization. There just aren't any. And the cost we now have, as your boss constantly tells us, that we now have a fifth of adults in many of our big cities out of work, you know, effectively not in the labour force. So we've got many problems downstream of it. I think on a broader point about who owns what, it's worth saying that running trade deficits will cause someone to own you, whoever it is. Just on the economics of international trade, you can only pay for your imports by exporting something or by getting into debt or by selling something you already have. And if you run, we haven't run a surplus in goods trade since 1983, and that was in the recession, basically. So we're in deep trouble. We have a massive trade problem. Unless we can solve that, someone is going to own you.
I want to come back to the patriotic point, though, because I was at a wedding last weekend in France, my French family, and I was talking to someone there who works for Amazon in France, and he was talking about the problems Amazon is having in France and how angry Amazon bosses are with the fact that they're just not getting the same level of penetration in France. And it's not to do with legislation, I don't think. It's a cultural thing. French people just aren't as interested in buying Amazon. They want to buy from French producers. We sort of have the same thing in Britain, but we're quite capable of deceiving ourselves that things are British when they're not, such as Cadbury's and so on.
Absolutely. And when you look at companies, Amazon is very overtly American, but there are many American companies that you'll deal with where you'll never realise at any point that it's American owned. But yes, you're right. The French and the Germans have an aversion to dealing with American companies, especially where there's a choice. Mm. And so Amazon have struggled in France, and it's a really interesting question as to whether they'll succeed there. But in terms of investments into the UK, the British government lump them all together. They say all inward investment is great, and they confuse. I mean, what's happened near to where William's based in the northeast is Nissan built a car factory there, and it's been very successful. They were putting real money in. They were building a new factory, putting in plant, training people, creating jobs, putting the factory into their network of suppliers. And it was a real positive. But that sort of investment is treated in exactly the same way by government statistics as an American purchase of an existing profitable UK company. Mm. And we need to start separating those two out. We need to say one is good, one is bad.
William, I don't know if you've seen. Have you watched This Is Wrexham?
I've heard of it. I haven't had time.
But I think that's a classic example of what we're talking about, because it's about pictures. You know, poor town, deindustrialised, terrible football team, and these two kind of glamorous Hollywood actors come in and save it. And it is, and in itself, it is an entertainment. It is a show, and that is an example of the way America actually is the culture now. And I'm not sure there's much we can do about it.
Yes, I think culturally dominance of just what people think of, what they're exposed to, how they think, we're going to struggle a wee bit with that. But just to return to Angus's point about investment, distinguishing FDI as selling the family silver or proper investment, Nissan is the example. That is the example of a manufacturing investment. My father's company were lucky enough to get the architecture contract for that and did very well out of it. But it gave the Northeast a trade surplus into the EU permanently, basically. I mean, it's just vastly, it's incredibly important.
When Freddie talks about the cultural impact through making films and so on, we often think, oh, Britain's very good at making films and creative industries, but we're distributing them through American channels, through Netflix, and if they do well, the rights are bought up by, or that maybe the characters, like Winnie the Pooh, has been bought up by Disney. There's a cultural imperialism, I suppose, as well as a commercial imperialism.
Well, let's talk about the possible solutions a bit more. You list them at the end of the book, towards the end of the book. Stop the sell-offs is one. Another one is government should actively support innovation, and because that's something America does quite successfully. And I know Dominic Cummings was very interested in doing this too.
Yes. Yes, the Americans are brilliant at it. They've got a lot of funds, and a lot of funds go into it, and they've got a very good relationship between industry and universities, and they've created to use an American expression, an ecosystem in California that, particularly in California, but across the country, that allows entrepreneurs to get startup capital. We need to do more of that.
William, do you agree with that?
Totally, yeah. I think we like to brag about the number of top 100 global universities that we have and the innovation and science that we have in them, but we are very bad at transferring that out into manufacturing shop floor. It's a problem. I mean, I think things have improved recently with Sunak when he was chancellor, offering greater incentives for industrial investment. That's very, very helpful. But yeah, we can certainly do things about this. But the first stage, I think, which the book will help in, is making our political class aware that it's happening and that it matters. Those are the two things. And if you've got that, there's a whole list of things you can do. As you say, stop takeovers. You can put a turnover tax on multinationals, which I'd support. Change the tax code to stop prioritizing debt. Get a proper industrial policy. Monopoly and competition law must play a part in this, because you've got Amazon, I think, gets 30% of online sales, heading towards monopoly power, if it isn't already. Digital sales tax has been mentioned, and a culturally, you know, just buy British. If you did all those things, you would start dealing with the problem.
But I suppose it does need to start with awareness, which is what the book's about. There's no point in trying to impose a cure until you've had a diagnosis. And this is what I'm trying to do, to diagnose the problems of the UK, particularly in relation to our American masters. And the first part of any diagnosis is measurement. And this is why I was so horrified when I started writing the book, that I found I couldn't get the answers from the British, not just because they were hiding them, there was a bit of that, but mostly because they just weren't asking. They weren't asking how much of their spending on the NHS was going to US companies. They weren't measuring, and we've got to start doing that. For example, when I went to the ONS and asked them how many British people work for American companies, all they could do was say, we don't know, but we can make a good guess from this guide we subscribe to, Dun & Bradstreet, based in Florida. And I thought, we're so dependent on the Americans, not just commercially, but for information. And some of the best information I got for the book was from American agencies, the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, but also the Bureau of Economic Analysis in Washington, has demonstrated with hard numbers that Britain is the number one target for foreign investment by Americans.
Mm. Well, on information, that makes you think about the tech advantages America has. And I just wonder if there is anything that can be done about that. I mean, they have such a huge advantage now that can never be pulled back.
It's very hard, particularly when we allow them to be the leaders in our in emerging businesses here, so that AI is very much dominated already by US companies. But I think we've got to start with some determination to try to do something about it, a bit like you illustrated with the French in relation to Amazon.
Well, I mean, Rishi Sunak, on AI, Rishi Sunak wanted Britain to be a kind of Switzerland of AI, which was an interesting idea. But again, it didn't really seem to have anything concrete behind it. It was just a chance to have a good summit.
Yes, and after that summit, he had a long interview with Elon Musk, which sounded almost like a job interview.
It did, didn't it?
Gushing admiration for Elon Musk and what he's done. And of course, much of it's very impressive, but of course, much of it also is very imperial.
Yes.
Selling Tesla cars across the world and the Starlink system. And of course, ownership of... It's not just about information, it's about the platform. So the ownership of Twitter, I mean, this is our town square, and this is controlled from California.
Yes. William, do you think Rishi Sunak is a perfect exemplar of what we're talking about? And as Angus already said, I mean, he's probably going to lose the next election, and everybody expects he'll just go to California and live the very nice life of a very rich man.
Yes, I think he is, and I think Nick Clegg was before him. I think you can't imagine, actually, certain... Can you imagine Clement Attlee or Peter Shaw or Wilson just leaving and going off? No, it wouldn't happen, and it's a problem. But we can, we can certainly deal with these things if we want to. And on tech, actually, the first thing we should do is tax it properly.
Well, I think we will end it there. But thank you very much both for coming onto this Americano. It's been very interesting talking to you both. That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows, and urge you to leave a generous, kind, and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.